Thanks very much. And let me begin by expressing pleasure and modest surprise at being here, as well as thanks to Mark Skousen for inviting me. I did know Milton Friedman. We met once at my parents' house in Cambridge, and again by accident on the slopes at Alta in 1983, skiing together for 3 days in the company of William F. Buckley, Jr. In 1990, I was his sparring partner, along with a very taciturn David Brooks, for the reissue of the first episode of Free to Choose. You can look it up on YouTube. David has issued a lot of words since then. It might have been a psychological reaction to the fact that he didn't get any in on that occasion. Milton Friedman was a charming man, affable, if a bit pedantic, very difficult to dislike. That said, as I said long ago on a similar occasion, I'm here to bury Milton, not to praise him. Was Milton Friedman a Keynesian? It's a shocking question, and the most damaging one I could come up with. But I think the honest answer is that of course he was. And not merely on the evidence of his Nixon-era remark, "We are all Keynesians now," which he archly qualified with, "and no one is any longer a Keynesian." The deeper fact is that Friedman developed in the penumbra of Keynes at least three of his major ideas. Anyway, at least two of the three were offshoots of Keynes and Keynesian theory. The two clear cases are the permanent income hypothesis of 1957 and the natural rate of unemployment of 1968. The third case, monetarism, is more arguable, but I'll come to that in due course. The permanent income hypothesis, which was cited by when Friedman won the 1976 Riksbank Prize, is a gloss on the consumption function, which appeared as chapter 8. In Keynes's general theory. Keynes had offered, as you all know, the marginal propensity to consume as a simple constant with the inverse of the marginal propensity to save as the multiplier. Friedman split income into permanent or long-term expected and transient components, deflating the multiplier analysis that Keynes had adopted from Richard Kahn. Friedman's hypothesis was fanciful, or anyway, premature. When he offered it in 1957, it presupposed a middle-class society with stable habits and long-term horizons. This had not been the predominant mentality of the Depression, or even that of the early 1950s. James Duesenberry's relative income hypothesis, with its ratchet-like Veblen effects, was arguably more realistic for most US households at the time. The situation today, though, as you can see from this chart, is very different, as the surge in savings rates that came with pandemic relief demonstrated. Indeed, Friedman's latter-day disciples could have trotted out the permanent income hypothesis to defend President Biden from the charge that his big initiatives were stimulus and therefore inflationary. Curiously, or perhaps not, so far as I'm aware, they didn't do so. As permanent income is a gloss on the consumption function, so Friedman's natural rate of unemployment, also advanced by Ned Phelps, and later characterized as the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, NARU. Mark may remember who came up with that term. Was it Tobin? I'm not sure. Is a gloss on Paul Samuelson and Robert Solow's 1960 version of the Phillips curve, which itself is a barnacle on the hull of Keynes's economics. The Phillips curve was based on primitive econometrics and no theory. Tobin once wrote that it resembled Pirandello characters in search of a plot, giving the plot a famous twist. This was a standard trick of his. Friedman appended an adaptive expectations equation to the Samuelson solo artifact, and then showed that in the long run, when expectations and outcomes coincide, the resulting curve is nearly vertical, so that you can't reduce unemployment much without runaway inflation. Friedman thus stood the Keynesian case for full employment on his head. The whole argument is complete nonsense, and always has been. It would turn our advanced industrial and mostly private economy into a delicate and neurotic flower, prone to slip into hyperinflation at the slightest disturbance, or turn toward the New Deal, the Great Society, or any other program for the public good. Such a situation, were it the case, would drive any sane person to price controls and to rationing at the very least. And you can see from this graph, which actually details what happened through this period, is that when unemployment was falling, inflation did not rise until at some point it did, but it never rose at the same rate. So there is simply no basis for arguing that there was anything like a natural rate or stable natural rate of unemployment in the data from this period, the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, being shown on that graph. But the fault isn't Friedman's. It lay with Samuelson, Solow, and their many followers, including all the first generation linear modeling shops, Data Resources, Chase Econometrics, and Wharton, and their nth generation successors, who are still at work at the Federal Reserve, the Congressional Budget Office, who built the Phillips curve into their models and never got rid of it, although Keynes, Nicholas Kaldor, Robert Eisner, and I spun in our graves. In 1997, I published an article titled "Time to Ditch the Nehru" in the Journal of Economic Perspectives, based partly on theory, partly on a review of the evidence I just showed you, and partly on the dispositive fact that Alan Greenspan had demolished the myth of macroeconomic impossibility, or macroeconomic impossibility theorem. Full employment without inflation was possible. Who knew? But even in 2018, which by my count is 21 years later, the best Olivier Blanchard could manage in the same journal was an article titled with the pusillanimous question, "Should we reject the Nehru hypothesis?" I'd managed to raise two daughters to voting age in that interval before one of our most senior and respected macroeconomists got around to asking whether it might be time to do a little rethinking. And there is no evidence that Blanchard's gentle enjoinder was any more influential than the grenade I'd tried to throw a generation before. In fact, there never was a natural rate, or Nehru, because there never was a Phillips curve. It was an epiphenomenon of the 1960s in the United States, non-existent in national data for any for other countries. Again, I don't blame Friedman. My only point is that he was dissecting the corpse of a pseudo-Keynesian construct. The point is underscored by the fact that Friedman was uncomfortable with the further step taken by Robert Lucas, which Professor Bordas just talked about, to rational expectations and a fully vertical non-trade-off, which removed the pseudo-Keynesian underpinning and fully resurrected the pre-Keynesian classical thought, in which employment and output are determined in a labor market and money is a veil. I said that monetarism is a more complicated case. This may be because Friedman's monetary views strike me as a muddle of conflicting short and long periods and those famous long and variable lags. And here's just a quick excursion into the question of expectations, which remarked by the currently banished Professor Summers in the Financial Times, that inflation is set by inflation expectations, and inflation expectations are set by people who form inflation expectations, with the conclusion that inflation theory is in very substantial disarray. Professor Summers, who eulogized Milton Friedman in the New York Times, when he passed away. In any event, Milton Friedman himself could say almost anything. I ran across him speaking to a camera at these meetings in San Francisco once, and I heard him predict a big recession and a terrible inflation, both in consequence of the same monetary policy at slightly different time intervals. And when the reporter asked whether the average American family would be better off or worse off a year hence, he replied, and this is a quote embedded in my brain ever since I heard it, he said, "There is no such thing as the average American family. Some American families will be better off, and some American families will be worse off." That said, well, Friedmanites were generally monetarists. It is not the case that all Keynesians were simple-minded advocates of fiscal policy. The Keynes I studied at Cambridge in 1974 was a monetary theorist. He believed in the power of central banking and wrote in the General Theory, I quote, "Unemployment develops, that is to say, because people want the moon. Men cannot be employed when the object of desire, i.e. money, is something which cannot be produced and the demand for which cannot be readily choked off. There is no remedy but to persuade the public that green cheese is practically the same thing and to have a green cheese factory, i.e. a central bank, under public control." The tendency of early post-war Keynesians to downplay the Federal Reserve, in his 1968 lecture, Friedman cites Alvin Hansen and Arthur Smithies as examples, was a consequence of its minor role in the war. And in this respect, Friedman, who after all blamed the Fed for the Depression, was more in line with Keynes, not less so. He did believe that monetary policy could drive the real economy up as well as down in the short run. And in this respect, as noted above, he was also Keynesian in a way that Lucas was not. For the long run, however, and whatever that means, Friedman believed in money neutrality and in a money growth rule consistent with price stability. This can be expressed as MV equals PT or PY as in the license plate, with M as the policy tool, V a technological constant, and T determined by equilibria in various Valrasian markets. This, of course, reflects the pre-Keynesian monetary ferment Irving Fisher, the marginalists, an overlay of business cycle analysis going back to Wessel Ker Mitchell and the young Arthur Burns. Publicly created helicopter money became a controlling metaphor, pushing endogenous bank money into the background via money multiplier mechanisms, which are essentially the Keynes con method transposed onto the central bank. Theoretically and ideologically, it was all a terrible mess. Taken up and expressed in policy by Friedman, and especially by his students, is a demand for money growth rules. You can see that happened around 1968. These were adopted, at least rhetorically, by Paul Volcker in 1979. And there was a 2-6% annual growth rule for M1 is what I remember. With the result, as soon as it was announced, the technological constant of monetary velocity started behaving, as you can see on that diagram. All of which bubbled over into debates over the definition of money, leading Kenneth Boulding to rhyme, "We must have a good definition of money, for if we do not, then what have we got but a quantity theory of no one knows what?" The money growth rules did serve one very valuable purpose, not necessarily one of which Friedman would have approved. In the mid-1970s, on the staff of the House Banking Committee, I allied with my monetarist friends and Friedman students, Bob Weintraub and Bob Auerbach, to use them as a wedge in setting up the growth rules, not the students, a regular process for Federal Reserve accountability on monetary policy, which became the Humphrey Hawkins hearings under the Full Employment and Balanced Growth Act of 1978, for which I drafted Section 108, the monetary policy provisions. You couldn't ask the Fed back then about interest rates. Too sensitive, they'd say, perhaps citing Friedman also on his 1968 claim that the Federal Reserve can't control the interest rate. Well, you know, I think no differently. The Federal Reserve does control the interest rate, doesn't control the inflation rate. But you could ask about their monetary growth targets precisely because the answer carried less information. In the same era, in early 1981, when I had become executive director of the Joint Economic Committee, the Fed's congressional liaison, Don Wynn, stopped by to ask a favor. Could they discontinue sending semi-annuals or possibly quarterly letters demanded by Senator William Proxmire on whether M1 was growing at between 2 and 6%? I said, sure. The letters stopped. I did not mention it to Proxmire, and no one ever noticed. Friedman himself, and to his credit late in his life, decided he had pushed those rules too hard. In these matters, I've argued, some of Friedman's biggest ideas were framed by Keynes and Keynes's followers, and in that sense, he belongs to the Keynesian era as a dissenting Keynesian. Yet he also held on to pre-Keynesian dogmas of perfect competition, long-term equilibrium, money neutrality in the long run, all pre-modern constructs that Jing Chen and I document and debunk in our new book, Entropy Economics, published last year to the discomfort, I fear, of Milton's ghost by the University of Chicago Press. Among other things, we also note that Friedman's principle of profit maximization as the sole or even leading as the sole or even leading objective of business in a free market economy is neither necessary nor sufficient. You can maximize and still make losses, in which case you will disappear. You can not maximize and still earn profits, in which case you will survive. The idea that you should maximize at each moment in time is a sophistry for spoiled children and economists. Keynes, like Schumpeter and my father, but unlike Samuelson Solow and the MIT or so-called American Keynesians, had slipped away from these 18th century doctrines, repurposed at the 19th century to keep Karl Marx out and Henry George down. Keynes, who managed to break through and effect for a time an actual revolution in economic thought, was all about short-term pragmatism and cumulative causation. I have likewise argued that the most successful countries in today's world, including China, Korea, and Japan, at least before the 1990s crisis, followed Keynes, Schumpeter, and my father, John Kenneth Galbraith, while Friedman and his acolytes prevailed here. Friedman, like Samuelson, like Solow, would have been a better Keynesian and a better economist if he had been even more true to the influence that Keynes had over him than he actually was. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And finally, we have Judy Shelton.